Ganley. This is NHPR News. It's now 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. March is known for coming in like a lion. It's a windy month, but this year March has also been a bluster with the political issue of wind power. In the legislature, two Senate bills putting some restrictions on wind projects and how they're sited are now making their way through the House. Meanwhile, at several town meetings in central New Hampshire, turbines were a hotter issue than taxes, with voters approving anti-wind warrants by wide margins. Also, town officials in Groton are examining the license of a wind farm there, leading the developer to pause another one of its proposed projects. Although wind power has received a lot of pushback recently, this alternative energy is still expanding here, albeit more slowly than backers had hoped. The problem is, while those spinning turbines do provide a carbon-free source of electricity, major questions remain about how green wind really is, especially how you measure that greenness with a national, statewide, or local perspective. Today in The Exchange, which way New Hampshire is blowing when it comes to wind? Let's hear from you. Should this be a power source our state pursues or not? Why do you think wind has proven so controversial here? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. We have three guests. Joining us from Gorham is Dave Publicover. He's senior staff scientist at the Appalachian Mountain Club. His areas of expertise include conservation, land management, and wind power siting policy. And Dave Publicover, good to have you. Welcome back to The Exchange.
Nice to be on. Thank you.
Also with us, Taylor Caswell. He's chair of the brand new New Hampshire Clean Tech Council. He's worked in sustainable development for many years in energy and housing. And Taylor Caswell, nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks, Laura.
And also with us, Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter. He's done a lot of reporting on wind this year. And Sam, thank you for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here, Laura.
Well, Sam, I read a couple headlines just from this month and February and January. Just give us an overview, Sam, of where New Hampshire seems to be at this moment with wind power.
So I'd say the answer to that is that we've really, so there's three wind farms that have been sited in the state, but beyond them, there's probably, we're at a sort of a stalling point. There's three other developers have talked about building wind farms in the Newfound Lake region. One of those has basically put their application on hold. They were the one that was farthest along. One more has talked about putting up a MET tower, which is basically the first step. You start to measure the wind and get an idea if you could put up a wind farm there. And that the MET tower, of course, has hit resistance with the locals. But apart from those two, there's no activity. So we're basically in a holding pattern.
Now, you've been covering this for a couple of years. What do you make of this, Sam? I mean, it seems like a few years ago, people thought that there would be more wind at this point.
Well, I would say that what happened is you had two wind farms that went up in pretty remote location. Well, not remote per se. One is very remote, one down in Leominster, a little less remote, but had a fair degree of local buy-in. The third went in Groton, and it could be seen from Newfound Lake, could be seen from a lot of communities that didn't have a say in whether or not it went up. It caught a lot of people by surprise, and I'd say the Groton wind farm is really what started sparked the backlash.
Dave Publicover, what do you think? Where are we feeling about wind these days? How are we feeling, and where are we at?
Well, I think Sam got it right. The developers initially, look for sort of the least controversial sites. Leominster seems to be one that was fairly broadly accepted. But New Hampshire is a pretty limited landscape. It's a small state. It puts a high value on open space lands. And because of where wind has to go, there really are a very limited number of options. And there's a lot of public land that has high recreational use. There's a high value put on wildlife habitat. So New Hampshire is much different than Iowa, where you can pretty much put a turbine in any cornfield. We're very constrained. So I think the opportunities for a significant expansion of wind in New Hampshire are fairly limited. There may be some other sites that would receive public acceptance. Certainly local acceptance is one of the critical factors that's driving where wind might be sited.
Yeah, local hard to define, though, sometimes, isn't it, Dave? I mean, town A may like it where the facility is actually located, but the surrounding towns may not, so it's tricky.
Yeah, and certainly these would be considered projects of regional impact because the impacts, especially the aesthetic impacts, do go beyond the town boundaries. And oftentimes, the town where it's sited may get the benefits, the tax benefits and others. The surrounding towns may get some of the impact, but none of the benefit.
Taylor, I'd love to get you into this, too. What do you think? Other states, especially in the Midwest and West, are moving ahead with wind. You go out there, you see turbines everywhere. Why is New Hampshire stalling on this?
Well, I would say that New Hampshire is stalling a little bit on a number of different renewable issues. Our organization really advocates a wide number of different alternatives when it comes to what types of renewable generation are available. I mean, you've got solar power, you've got solar PV, you've got solar thermal, you've got biomass, you've got geothermal, and you've got wind. And there's a lot of different choices. So wind, in our opinion, is not the only choice that there is available. I think when we start getting down to it, particularly in New England, what we're talking about are process issues. The process is set up pretty adequately if you're building some other type of power plant in a more urban area. But it's not necessarily set up as one that can adequately take into account all the issues Dave just brought up. I mean, yeah, we have limited landscape in New Hampshire. We have viewpoints that people really become very much part of their own values and how they want to live their life and where they are. So that has to be brought into account somehow. But at the same time, I don't think we can completely just dismiss wind power as completely not – can't be part of our overall energy portfolio in the state.
So when you say, the process, do you mean, Taylor, local control, local governance, the way we manage things here is not conducive to these projects?
Well, I can give you an example. I've been involved with a number of different development projects, both on the energy side and on the affordability side. And in particular, I've done some work helping to develop housing for homeless veterans. And, these are things that generally you would think would be accepted by people. I mean, with the a couple of exceptions, renewable power generally is widely accepted by people. You've got and helping people that are in need is another area that you normally would see some support. But that's not always the case. And I think that a lot of that's because when we come in as developers or others come in and sit in front of a zoning board meeting and start flapping up these huge maps and say, this is what we're going to do to your town. I mean, people are going to naturally be very defensive when that happens. I know I would be. So I think what we need to be doing is looking more at a process that involves communities right from the very beginning. And, I've done a lot of work in sustainable development and what's called integrative process development. And that's really what it's aimed at is how do we get what we need but recognize and understand the value systems that different communities have?
Our phone number here in the exchange for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, weighing wind power in the Granite State, where we're at this point in time with this source of alternative energy. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. What do you think? Should wind power be an energy source that our state pursues or not? Why do you think wind has become so controversial here, given the rapid development in some other states? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. So here's the big question, guys, and Sam, I'll turn to you first. How do you measure the greenness of wind? What big factors do folks take into account?
That, of course, is kind of an impossible question because you're weighing things like the benefits of reducing CO2, which wind power definitely does. I mean, this has been a claim that some wind opponents have made is that cycling issues with power plants and et cetera cause the energy generated by wind to be offset by energy generated elsewhere by fossil fuel plants. I'd say that there's not much evidence for that. But CO2 is reduced. Carbon-emitting power plants do run less when the wind is blowing, if there's wind on the grid. But you're weighing that against things that are, it's impossible to stand them up next to each other and measure them with the same yardstick. I mean, things like habitat impacts, things like visual impacts on a place that is recognized as being scenically beautiful. I mean, how do you weigh that against a little bit of carbon taken out of the grid? I mean, it's just impossible.
So, Dave, what do you think? And I'm going to ask you the question through a Facebook comment from Bobby, who says, at this point, wind seems like a better option than more coal, natural gas, or Northern Pass. Thanks, Bobby, for that comment. What do you think, Dave?
Well, I would agree with that. But unfortunately, we don't have a centralized command and control system that can define where our energy sources come from. We have a deregulated system with a market-based approach. When wind is generating and it goes into the grid, the climate change benefit depends on what type of electricity is being displaced. If it's displacing hydropower, there's no carbon benefit. In our region, it's usually displacing natural gas, so there is some benefit. Clearly natural gas is a fossil fuel source. It would be even better if it could displace coal, but that's just not the way the grid operates in our region. It's also important to consider it in terms of a larger energy policy or strategy. I mean, I think it's critical, and one of our major lacks has been our inability to enact any kind of policy that actually controls carbon emissions, whether it be a cap and trade or a carbon tax type of system. Without that, wind power, may just end up being one more way to feed an ever-increasing energy demand. And while it may slow the rate of carbon release, in the end, it may just be delaying the inevitable. If it doesn't actually, help displace some sort of carbon source under a cap, again, it's just slowing the rate at which we feed the pig, but the pig is still getting bigger.
So is it green or not? I think I hear what you're saying, but could you be a little more specific? I mean, if it displaces some coal use, isn't that green?
Again, I think it is, but in the end, is it serving the ultimate goal of limiting how much carbon ultimately gets into the atmosphere? If the answer is yes, it can be considered green. If the answer is no, if it's just delaying but not stopping the release of certain amounts of carbon, it's much less effective.
All right. We will talk more. Dave, I got to cut you off there. I apologize. I'll let you finish up after a short break. And Taylor, I want to hear from you, too. You can join us as well. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Tables are running out for NHPR's second annual Trivia Smackdown. Sign up your team and brush up on your trivia. You could be this year's champ on April 18th, but first you have to enter at nhpr.org. This event made possible in part by Lincoln Financial Group. More on wind power in the Granite State on the Exchange and a 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. Former President Jimmy Carter on discrimination against women and other critical issues today. Mostly cloudy, windy across New Hampshire today. Slight chance of snow showers, highs upper 20s to mid-30s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from the Rooted Group, serving successful families and businesses with sophisticated planning and investment management for over 30 years at UBS Financial Services, member FINRA SIPC. MBCM Environmental and Land Law, solutions for a sustainable New Hampshire. Lawyers representing developers, farmers, nonprofits, and individuals. NHLandLaw.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're weighing wind power in the Granite State. Our guests are Taylor Caswell, chair of the New Hampshire Clean Tech Council, Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter, and Dave Publicover. He's senior staff scientist at the Appalachian Mountain Club. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange, all one word. And Dave, I did want to let you finish up your point on this question of whether wind is really green or not. Go ahead.
Yeah, I also just wanted to address the question of habitat impacts. Again, putting turbines in an Iowa cornfield, not much habitat impact. Putting it in New Hampshire, where they're pretty much all put in forested landscapes, it depends on the kind of forest. Common, second growth, young, low elevation forest is less of a concern. Turbines that are located in high-elevation spruce fir habitat in the North Country that supports rare species like pine marten and Bicknell's thrush is more of a concern. So it's not a question of whether it's green or not. It's a question of, how how far down a scale of impacts are we willing to go, and what types of trade-offs are we willing to make for one type of public benefit, which is reducing carbon emissions, versus other types of public benefits, which is preserving important open space.
So it sounds like you're saying, Dave, you know, your opposition is not to wind per se, but more that it's just not a great fit for New Hampshire. It might be fine for Iowa.
Well, it's not accurate to say we oppose wind. We accept that wind is going to be part of the energy mix in New Hampshire. Our focus is on the siting and where it's located. It belongs in some places, and in other places it doesn't. And our focus has been on trying to get the state to act better, enact better policies to better define that line as to what type of a site is acceptable and what type is not.
And we'll get into that site evaluation committee issue. Yeah, in just a moment. Dave, I want to let Taylor jump in here, too. On this big question, Taylor, of how green is wind, and then lots of comments from our listeners. Go ahead, Taylor.
Well, yeah, I mean, I agree with what Dave's saying. I don't think there's much debate over whether wind is green or not. I mean, we are getting a fuel source that's free. It's the wind. We're not having to pay for it. It's not having to be imported from Venezuela or New York State. It's New Hampshire. It's our wind when it crosses the state border. But I think the issue, two issues I'd bring up. One is, you know, Dave talks about balance. Absolutely agree. I mean, life is about balance. We all have our work-life balance. We have many different balances in life. As it relates to this, I mean, we're really trying to balance human needs with planet needs in the end. I mean, we've got a situation where climate change is having a significant impact on an increasing amount of everyone's everyday life. And you talk about issues like natural resources and the habitats that Dave is mentioning. And really the carbon outputs are damaging the planet. But at the same time, we certainly are concerned about cost. We're concerned about the view impact that this has. And that's the more human side of that. But I don't think that we can too heavily weigh that balance in one direction or the other. It needs to be balanced in some way.
Well, what about the idea, though, that Dave has expressed that it's just difficult in New Hampshire? Again, mm-hmm. We're small. We have these highly valued public spaces. We've got a lot of forests. We've got ridgelines that people value. There aren't that many great places to site wind, unlike in Iowa or California or a Montana or an Idaho. What do you think? It's not so much that wind isn't a good choice. It's just not a good choice for New Hampshire.
Well, I think the drive to build any sort of energy generation, whether it's solar, wind, or natural gas, is driven by demand, right? I mean, and we're seeing a decrease in demand nationally for electricity, thermal power, as we get more efficient, as cars get more efficient, as our appliances get more efficient. I really think that there needs to be a huge emphasis on using energy efficiency as a generation source. So rather than saying, you know, we're going to build a new natural gas plant or we're going to need, you know, 500 megawatts worth of wind or solar or anything else, I'd almost rather just see us not use that energy in the first place.
Put the pig on a diet, as Dave
right,
said.
Right, put the pig on a diet.
Here, here.
All right, let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook, NHPR Exchange, all one word. Post a comment there. Let's go to Carol in Grantham. Hi, Carol. Go ahead. Thanks for calling the exchange.
Good morning. I am very concerned about what's going on in New Hampshire in particular about wind energy and all of the opposition that seems to have been stirred up. I don't truly understand what's wrong with wind power in many people's minds because I can see the Leominster plant from my living room. And I think it's interesting to watch. However, the first thing that many of us heard about wind energy being a serious matter in this part of the world was when we first started hearing that there was going to be wind machines out near Nantucket, and the Kennedys were against it. So I guess what it seems to me what happened in a lot of people's minds is, well, if the Kennedys don't like it, we shouldn't like it either.
The Cape Wind Project, which did take a long time to get up and running. What do you think, Dave? She doesn't get what the opposition is all about.
Well, again, there's you know, I have no comment on Cape Wind because that's an ocean issue. Though I will say that by far the greatest potential for wind power development in New England is offshore, and especially deep offshore. You know, where you can put it farther out, where it's not impacting the scenic quality of the shorelines. That's really the holy grail of wind power development in New England, and the potential is far greater than terrestrial.
Is it, though? Because can I ask you that, Dave? Because, you know, it would seem easy, right? It's far offshore. Nobody has to look at it. But it did take forever to get that Cape Wind project moving.
Yeah, I mean, Cape Wind had its particular challenges because it was, you know, where it was located. Deep offshore, the challenge is not, is more technological, trying to develop floating wind platforms that can stand up to the New England ocean environment. So, you know, that's something that may be 5 to 10 years down the road.
Sam, I've read that there is a lot of interest in New Hampshire coordinating with Massachusetts and Maine in offshore wind.
So, yeah, I mean, New Hampshire is definitely not out front on this issue. And the University of Maine is probably the technological leader in this front there. They've already deployed a sort of a 1/8 scale model of a floating wind turbine design that they'd like to be able to put out in deep water. And then again, in terms of actually putting a commercial project online, Massachusetts has, you know, there's Cape Wind is first, but there's a couple other projects that may come online, smaller ones that may come online after it. So New Hampshire's definitely not out front there. They are looking at passing a bill that would create a sort of a study commission. So everyone else is acting, we're studying, and that's probably just a factor of the fact that we only have 16 miles of coastline.
Right. What do you think? Do you want to jump in on that, Taylor? And then I've got a lot of emails that I want to hear.
Well,
share
I think Carol's comment really goes to the point that different people see these things very different ways. And, you know, I talked about value systems that each individual has, and you know, people just see it differently, and that's the case with any one of these projects.
Here's an email that just came in from Amy, who says, regarding is it green, one question is whether the relatively small amount of energy produced and carbon offset is worth the relatively extensive impacts of the roads and turbine pads required for the facility and the secondary impacts of those, including forest fragmentation, impacts to wildlife corridors, invasive species, stormwater runoff, and more. Thanks, Amy, for the email. You know, Taylor, this is a critique that I've heard of wind. You know, a lot of impacts, and you don't get that much power in return. What do you think about that? Thank you, Amy.
I would say, in terms of the power, I mean, we're not looking to run the state of New Hampshire on renewable generation. It's really just part of a larger portfolio. And I think you can look to this past winter with the infamous polar vortex. And, you know, we had a number of instances where natural gas electricity generation was running at capacity and getting very close to having some pretty negative consequences. Across the region, wind power and renewable power in general was able to sort of cover the gap in a lot of ways, providing between 5 and 13% of the energy load. That really was the difference in a couple of cases. And the ISO in New England has basically said that. So it's not to be discounted. I don't think any of us are saying that we're going to, within 5 or 10 years, be running New England completely off of renewable sources, but it has to be part of the mix.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dave. I would agree. You're not going to replace Seabrook with wind power in New Hampshire. It may only be a few percent of the solution, but Bill McKibben once said, solving the climate change issue is there's no one magic bullet. It's going to require 20 different solutions, each of which is 5% of the total.
So, Dave, given that you feel that way, what about the opposition to wind? I mean, are you in a way working against what Bill McKibben says?
No. Again, it's not fair to say that we're opposed. There's been something like over 20 commercial wind power projects that have come before permitting agencies in New England. I think we've opposed in whole or part maybe 4 or 5 of those. The rest we've not had any problem with. Our emphasis is on significant impacts to what we call ecological or scenic resources of state or national significance. So we're concerned with, you know, the major state parks, you know, sort of the rare and sensitive wildlife habitats, things like that. We don't address issues of local concern. So, you know, in terms of whether people want to see this in their backyard, you know, we don't discount that. We don't fight those battles. We don't take a stand on those battles. And each locality is going to have to come to grips on on that on their own.
Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. One of the big issues that we've touched on, gentlemen, but I want to dig into a little bit more with you. And Sam, I'll start with you. The who decides issue. Dave mentioned that his group has intervened in a couple of these instances, but not that many. In New Hampshire, Sam, who's the deciding body for whether these projects will be built or not?
Oh, it's my favorite subject. this is the Site Evaluation Committee. They are currently about a 15-member body composed of a lot of department heads and staff from public utilities, from Department of Environmental Services, to DRED, which is Economic Development. And they come together, and it's this sort of unwieldy body that takes a very deep dive into each application that's been put forward. And right now there's a bill that's working its way through the House and Senate that would reform that body. It would shrink it down. Well, so every time it goes before a committee, it gets a complete rewrite. So the current form is that it would shrink it down to 9 members. 2 of those members would be from the public, and one of them would be an attorney. Both of them would have some sort of expertise in either energy or business or basically working it out, collaborative, problem solving. And so it would shrink it down a little bit. It would hire a professional staff member, because this has been one of the complaints, is that it's an ad hoc body. And so
really, the Site Evaluation Committee doesn't have a professional staff, because
no.
It makes big decisions.
Yes, and they just come together whenever there's a decision before them, and it pulls on the resources of all those departments. And that's been one of the complaints, is that it's an under-resourced body. And at one point, the Commissioner of DES said that it was sort of near a breaking point last year, and so this is what's pushed for this professional staff member. So it would get some staff support, it would get some extra funding, and basically the idea is that they want to streamline the body and make it a little more expert.
And so the SEC, the Site Evaluation Committee, Sam, gets to give the yay or nay to these large and small-scale projects.
Anything over, I believe the cutoff is 50 megawatts. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong there.
Sure.
But
30,
excuse me.
Yeah. And what about town and local input, Sam? I mean, again, a lot of these projects have been opposed by people who just are very worried about the landscape impacts, as Dave has mentioned, and also they don't want to see these things. So how much input do they have?
So town input is considered, and this is why you've seen a lot of these votes at town meeting, is because that basically goes into the SEC, is like, we're on record as opposing this thing and we're the next town over. So that's what those votes are really all about. So that input is considered as one of the factors amongst many over whether or not a project is approved or denied.
So it sounds like at the end of the legislative season, Sam, the Site Evaluation Committee may look different than it does today.
And we'll see. It might get rewritten 3 more times before it comes out, but that's the current form.
Let's go back to our listeners. Lots of people who want to jump in our conversation. Ray is calling from Litchfield. Ray, thanks for hanging on. You're on the exchange.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Boy, I have a couple questions, but the first one was how does New Hampshire stack up against the other New England states in regards to land-based wind turbine farms, as opposed to the offshore stuff? You know, because we saw the big opposition to Cape Wind and all that. But do other states have wind farms? And the second question I have is, do we need like giant turbines, because as you go down to Boston on 93, you see a wind turbine. I think it's around Somerville or something like that. But are those more practical for maybe southern New Hampshire, putting some of those up? Because in Litchfield, we have a lot of farmland, and along the Merrimack River, is that something practical, maybe smaller wind turbines?
You know, Ray, that's such a good question. I want to take your second question first, because it's one I want to explore with you, gentlemen. And Taylor, to you first. Sometimes the problem is, perhaps, he's saying, that these things are just too big. Are we not looking at this the right way in terms of scale? If these projects were smaller, would we see these problems with wind development?
I think the challenge with wind is that for it to really make sense economically, it needs to be at a larger scale.
In terms of megawatts.
Yeah. I think it's pretty hard to say that going around and putting little windmills on everybody's houses and hoping that that's going to interconnect into the grid in a way that has the impact that we would like it to have, which is to be part of the overall region's energy portfolio, it's fairly difficult. So I think the thing to look at is, as far as wind goes, we've got six states in New England, all of which are part of the ISO grid in New England, with varying sorts of resource availabilities in terms of land and water. I think having a regional strategy as it relates to wind is probably got to be part of the answer.
What do you think about this, Dave? Micro versus macro. We hear opposition to what people call industrial wind. I have heard some people talk about putting small turbines even on the tops of office buildings, for example. I mean, is this feasible right now? Is anyone seriously looking at this?
Yeah, it's certainly feasible. I mean, it's the difference between, again, what you call industrial or commercial scale. It ranges all the way down from community scale, like Hull, Massachusetts has two turbines, two fairly large turbines that serve its local energy, public energy utility, to the types of turbines you see that, you know, maybe 40 or 50 feet high behind somebody's barn. And there's a role for all of it. I agree with Taylor that a lot of small wind turbines are not going to, power New Hampshire. But I think the idea of distributed generation is one that's going to be a much larger part of our energy mix in the future. I think probably solar has much bigger potential than wind. I think we're getting to the point where solar is now becoming economically reasonable in terms of the payback periods. I would hope that at some point in the near future we would see solar arrays on the top of every Walmart and Lowe's. And on top of every office building. I mean, I think that is something that really needs to be talked about as, that can make a significant contribution to our energy future is distributed solar.
Yeah, Ray, thank you for raising
that. I think that's an important
that.
Part of the future. It gets away from the model, the typical commercial model of large centralized facilities, but I really think that's an important part of the future that needs to be considered.
Sam, real quick to you.
Yeah, so basically one thing I want to say is the reason you don't see large-scale investment by large firms in micro wind is that the dollars per watt just isn't there. I mean, the reason that you see them investing in these big farms is because they're cheaper per megawatt produced, so they can make more money. You're not going to get the return that an investor wants investing in micro wind. It might work for a homeowner. It might take 20 years to pay it off, but they're okay with that if they're a homeowner.
Okay, Ray, thanks a lot for that point. We'll take more of your questions and comments after a short break. 1-800-892-6477. Keep it right here.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a conversation with former President Jimmy Carter on discrimination against women and other critical issues of today. Then a special reader's review on the benefit and joy of reading fiction, all coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Hillsborough House, a locally owned nursing facility, improving the experience and delivery of rehab and residential care for over 50 years. Information at hillsboroughhouse.org. And Symphony New Hampshire Orchestra and Chorus performing Fauré's Requiem, MBZ's Symphony in C on March 29th in Nashua. Tickets at symphonynh.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, we explore what net neutrality is all about. We'll talk with the author of a new book who explains the issue. That's tomorrow in The Exchange. Today in The Exchange, a look at wind power in New Hampshire. You can join us with your questions, comments, thoughts, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. All one word. Eric's waiting in Portsmouth. Hi, Eric. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
Thanks very much. Great topic. I just wanted to bring to the attention the fact that, you know, that there's many people that don't, you know, like this process and, you know, not in their backyard and the development of offshore wind. But it's not well understood what the consequences are to the marine environment, you know, from a fishing perspective. And These transmission lines have the potential of changing habitat conditions and so on and so forth. It's not well. There's not a lot of data to support that. You know that this type of project isn't going to have an effect on on the marine environment.
Yeah, and
but
Eric,
everybody says,
yeah, you're a fisherman. We've talked before, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we have more.
So you're out there in your boat and concerned about running into a wind turbine, perhaps.
Well, you know, yeah, it, with the development of it, it just seems to be that everybody says, put them offshore, put them offshore. Everybody, you know, put them out, you know, out of our line of sight. But we don't know that the transmission lines are going to have an effect on the, you know, on fish habitat or anything on the benthic bottom that isn't going to cross those transmission lines because of the emissions that they might produce.
It's
something that there isn't an answer for yet, and it would be a tragedy to put these things out here and see that the sensitivity to the marine environment's been affected by this as a byproduct.
Well, Eric, it's good to hear from you. And Sam, real quickly, I'm guessing this is something that this new study committee is going to be looking at.
It is something that they'll
be
looking
into.
The study commission is mainly concerned with economic benefits. So, you know, we'll see exactly how much they get into that. But I have seen a few studies about impacts to marine environment. There was one that came out just recently about whales and dolphins, basically, and found very little impact to them from the sound of the wind turbines. I haven't seen anything about transmission, but you know, the emissions from transmission lines are something that's pretty well understood at this point. There's not a whole lot of evidence of health impacts from you know, in the sort of 70s and 80s. There was a lot of concern about air ionization that not a lot of science has piled up in support of that. But he's right in a certain sense that we haven't done a whole lot of study on the impacts of the marine environment. But unfortunately, the only way to do those studies is to put up a wind farm and then do them. So, you know, it depends on your perception of the risk. So if you perceive that to be too high of a risk, then you're going to think that these are a bad idea.
Well, Eric, thank you for the call. And here's an email from Nancy in Hopkinton. She says the two largest wind power companies in New Hampshire are owned by foreign corporations, Iberdrola, a Spanish-based company, and Brookfield Asset Management, a Canadian-based company. She says, according to Wikipedia, most of the wind power generated in New Hampshire is exported. She says, what are the benefits to New Hampshire? Do either of these multinational corporations pay any business profits tax? This is a point that others have raised, too, and I'll throw it to you, I think, Taylor. You know, we keep talking about benefit to New Hampshire, but the concern is, A, these companies are from out of country, and B, that New Hampshire may not need the wind that they produce.
Well, to the issue of where they're owned, I mean, the energy industry is an international industry, and it's difficult to probably find companies in New Hampshire that have the scale to be able to build farms like this that really ultimately do have benefit. And I think that the benefit, you know, aside from the environmental benefit of displacing fossil-based fuel, you know, what typically happens is that the power is sold either to the grid or to an off-taker, a power purchase agreement. And that agreement is got in at probably between 10 and 25 years worth of defined price. So once you build one of these renewable generation systems, you're able to define what exactly it's going to cost your off-takers to use that electricity, because it is not subject to the whims of geopolitical issues. So, you know, there is not a cost for wind. So they can define it. So the off-taker then has an ability to budget for 20 years. It takes away the volatility. It becomes part of their energy mix that protects against the volatility in the fossil markets.
Well, and to that second point that I made, I got an email from Rich in Antrim who says, last year the Site Evaluation Committee twice denied a permit for industrial wind development in Antrim. During the state hearings, Rich says it came out that the developers were not able to find any potential buyer of their proposed power in New Hampshire. The only company considering a power purchase agreement with them was Rhode Island. So Rich says, if the power is not needed here, why should New Hampshire push so hard to sacrifice our ridges, property values, wildlife corridors, to keep Providence office buildings lit up? So that's that second concern, Taylor.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, to go back to my point earlier, I think that we really are in a situation where we see decreasing demand across the country, and we need to be able to match the generation to the demand, understanding that, you know, demand really fluctuates quite a bit over the course of a year.
All right. Well, thanks for that email, Rich, and for the earlier one. Let's go back to our callers. And Ashley is calling from Marlborough, Vermont. Hi, Ashley. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thanks so much. I just wanted to call and follow up on a couple of the environmental concerns and ecological, especially wildlife ones, that have been brought up. reflecting a couple experiences I had as a grad student, one as a TA, and hearing the class that I was in charge of being presented to by a leading professor in mammalogy, who made the comment that, in his opinion, if all of the proposed wind developments in the state went in, that would lead to the extirpation, the local extinction from the state of several native migratory bat species. And also, separately in a different grad school, a different professor, an off-the-cuff comment that he would rather see offshore oil drilling than offshore wind because of the impacts to migratory bird species. So the idea being that these are things that interfere with flight paths, and at least in the case of bats, are attractant. They bring in insects. The bats go after the insects. They dodge the blades, but there's a low pressure behind the blades, and the lungs collapse. And so these are the impacts in addition to direct impacts to ridgelines and watersheds.
You know, Ashley, thank you for calling. We haven't specifically focused on species, bats and birds especially. And boy, Dave, we could probably do a whole hour on this, but what can you tell us about the impact on bats and birds? That's long been a concern.
Well, certainly bats are currently one of the biggest concerns. There were some large mortality events of bats at a couple of wind farms in West Virginia and Pennsylvania, and it has been demonstrated that wind farms pose a particular risk to certain types of bats, certainly basically resident tree-dwelling bats in the vicinity, and that the open corridors created may actually be a kind of an attractive nuisance that the bats come into these areas to feed. There has been a lot of work. There's a group called Bat Conservation International that's been working on this, and they have developed operational procedures that have a very high potential to significantly reduce bat mortality, which is primarily raising the wind speed at which the blades start turning. You know, there's sort of a zone of wind speed, of low wind speeds at which the bats are active, but the blades are turning, and that's the kind of the high risk period. Once the wind speed gets up to a certain level, the bats, it's too windy for them, and they go back into the trees. And if you set that as when the blades start turning, you can significantly reduce the bat mortality. And that's becoming, I think, a fairly standard requirement for most projects. It should be a standard requirement for all projects.
Wow, that's interesting. Well, here's an email from on this similar point from Gail in Concord. She says, somewhere I have seen wind towers that are not fan-shaped, which is deadly to birds, but spiral-shaped. The spiral sits close to the tower but still catches the wind. Gail says, I don't understand why these are not more than norm in wind power in light of their safer shape. Do you want to comment real quickly on that too, Dave?
I've seen some of these. There's a wide variety of turbine designs. I think those are sometimes called the egg beater. The reason they're not done is because they don't make economic sense for the developer. The developer gets to propose what kind of equipment they want to use, and the permitting agency says yay or no to that. The permitting agency, you know, I suppose the legislation could pass law that says, you know, you have to use these kinds of turbines, but I think that gets a little bit beyond what they want to do. And whether they are effective in reducing, you know, bird and bat mortality, I have no idea. I haven't seen any information in that regard. So I just know they have not been used anywhere. They're really more experimental.
Gail, thanks for that email. Did you want to jump in, Taylor?
Just a quick comment on that. I think, you know, one of the things we try to do in the Clean Tech Council is really talk about innovation. And when you talk about innovation, we're talking about the inevitable innovation in the energy markets, and particularly in the renewable markets. And that's not just in wind and solar and geothermal. It's also in how we use energy. I mean, you look at companies like Tesla and SolarCity. The guy who runs that, Elon Musk, I think his name is. I mean, they are dumping huge money into the issue of energy storage and how that really is going to have really a monumental effect on the renewable sector. But I think the point of the caller is there are different innovations and designs that are out there that can be applied. It's just a matter of getting them to the point, as Avdei says, that makes economic sense to integrate into a system that is very economically tight as it is.
I want to ask you guys another question concerning another power project, not wind, but Northern Pass, the big hydropower project. And Sam, you've done a lot of reporting on it. Here's my question. I know we're not here to talk about Northern Pass, but we've seen in southern New Hampshire business groups getting involved in the Northern Pass debate, saying they like the idea of more energy options like this one that might lower cost. Nashua Chamber just came out in support of it this week of Northern Pass. The Manchester Chamber has also come out in support of Northern Pass earlier. Again, I know we're talking about wind today, but what do you think, Sam, how much might the business community get involved now in this wind power debate?
You know, I frankly haven't seen that happening. I'm not sure what it would take for that to happen. I think basically it would be up to groups like Taylor's to go and recruit support from unrelated industries. You know, you could imagine a world in which they would get behind projects like this if they were convinced that it was going to lower energy costs, if they were shown strong evidence that it was going to reduce energy costs. And, you know, considering what has been out there so far, that's unlikely to happen unless, you know, there's a strong lobby from interested groups.
Let's turn to you now, Taylor. And Dave, I want to hear from you too, but go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, to the extent that the fossil companies are able to make their case to business groups in southern New Hampshire and other parts of the state that if they don't have certain types of projects approved, that it's going to have this huge negative impact on their bottom lines. We don't necessarily have sort of the armies of PowerPoint producers and lobbyists and lawyers to be able to sit down and talk with these business groups on a much more larger scale, not just about the energy prices, but about how the clean tech sector and the innovations that come from this sector can benefit those chambers. We'd love to have the opportunity, but you know, I can't question anyone's motivations.
Dave, do you want to jump in?
I don't really have the economics are sort of beyond our area of expertise.
So you're more concerned with the habitat and so forth, the land disruption,
yes,
which you would probably argue has an economic impact.
It does, certainly given the, especially the scenic impacts, given the importance of the recreation and tourist sector to New Hampshire's economy. Certainly, clearly it has an impact there. So there's a trade-off there as well. I will say on the economics, I mean, we don't get involved in issues of energy prices. I have been at legislative hearings in Maine on certain types of wind bills that seemed to make sense to us. The people who were on the sort of pro-wind side invariably were dominated by people who were making money off of wind projects, and especially the people who were making money building them. You know, in terms of the economic benefits, it's often talked about the construction benefits and stuff. They do provide a lot of construction jobs for a short period, but in terms of employment, a large wind power project, you know, may have 5 or 6 permanent employees. So they're not I wouldn't consider it a large job creator in terms of permanent jobs, though it does create a lot of short-term construction jobs.
Sam, you want to jump in?
I was just going to say the real big question with wind that we haven't quite answered yet is how much, you know, the problem is that wind is often very far from load centers. And so as more wind comes online, there's going to have to be more transmission lines built. And the big question is how much are those lines going to cost? We've had a couple estimates coming out of the ISO, but they've been all over the map. They've, you know, depending on how it's developed, offshore versus onshore, how much, the range has been anywhere from $4 billion to $25 billion to put up these transmission line projects. So I think if you want to see business buying in, first of all, they've got to be convinced that this is going to happen, and an economic basis is not going to be passed on to ratepayers.
Well, will more wind come online? I mean, again, most of these big projects have been opposed.
Well, I think here in New Hampshire, we've been talking about this a whole bunch already. There aren't a whole lot of great sites. Maine has a great deal more. You probably see a lot of development up there. Canada has a huge amount. So these transmission lines that are being proposed to connect us to Canada will bring wind over the lines if they're ever built. And then if offshore can ever hit the price point, offshore does have an immense amount of capacity out there. But it has to become economical. And again, that hasn't proven to be the case yet.
Here's a Facebook comment that came in before the show from Mark, and I'll throw this to you, Dave. He says, these so-called environmentalists who attempt to stop wind farms because they offend their Luddite sense of bucolic tranquility. Alternative energy projects, Mark says, need to be legally indemnified. Cape Winds was blocked for over 9 years because it offended the pleasant views of millionaires. Of course, we're going to continue to burn megatons of carbon-based fuels for decades to come. This gets back to the original concern, doesn't it, Dave? You know, how do we measure the greenness? Should we go with wind because of the carbon or not?
Well, that's one viewpoint. I don't entirely agree with it. You hear it a lot. Essentially, the viewpoint that climate change trumps everything, and that you know, essentially all other considerations should be set aside to deal with that. You know, we don't agree with that. We think there are trade-offs to be made. We're certainly willing to accept impacts from wind power development that we would not be willing to accept from any other kind of development. And there's no question that climate change is a serious problem. But should we be, you know, sacrificing some of our most valuable open space areas? Again, when there are lots of other things that we can do in terms of energy, conservation, and efficiency. You drive down any commercial strip in New England at 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're amazed at how brightly it's lit up. Until we turn off those lights, maybe we should not be building, you know, sacrificing some of our most important open space areas to feed that pig again.
All right. Well, a vote for conservation, and everyone in the studio is nodding. I want to let you know that, Dave. Thank you very much, Dave, for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dave Publicover, again, senior staff scientist at the Appalachian Mountain Club. Taylor Caswell, it's good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Great to be here, Laura.
Chair of the brand new New Hampshire Clean Tech Council, Taylor Caswell has worked in sustainable development for a long time in energy and housing. Sam Evans-Brown, thank you also for being with us.
Anytime, Laura.
Sam Evans-Brown, NHPR's environment reporter. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Mikesell. Our volunteer is Alan Cohen. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, taking on the telecom industry with net neutrality, the concept that all websites are treated equally in terms of cost and access. There's rising concern that internet companies are gaining too much control over online content, but a court recently ruled in favor of the industry. We'll talk with the author of a new book called Captive Audience and see what may happen next. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio. The Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 o'clock. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Dartmouth Hitchcock, primary care doctors and nurses who put you at the center of health. 13 locations statewide. Information at d-hdocs.org. And Black Trumpet, a dining destination on the harbor in Portsmouth, dedicated to bringing guests closer to food and community of the New Hampshire seacoast. BlackTrumpetBistro.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. President Jimmy Carter has set a high bar for post-presidential accomplishments. He's written more than 24 books, been awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, and continues to work to solve problems around the world. In recent years, he